said the man. It was woven by the finest hand that ever picked up a distaff.
It was woven by me, said Cytada.
I know it, lady, said the man, and bowed deeply. She is not a lady, she is a slave, said the farmer. She's freer than you will ever be, said the man. Now get me your cloak, before I tear the skin from your back and wrap myself in that instead. The stranger's words seemed to sizzle through the farmer's mind. He felt as though he was frying in the juice of all his boasts, all his pretensions and weaknesses. He did as he was bid. The pale fellow stretched out his hand to Cytada, and it seemed to her that little points of light began to dance around her, tiny silver orbs, no bigger than seeds, glinting in a shimmering web. He put on the cloak she had made, drew it around him, and began to sing. Half beautiful is she, like the moon, and from her shall spring the moon-taker. Oh, the sun, it grows dark at the noon, and the wolf, in his dreams, is a waker. This last line seemed to amuse the fellow no end, and he burst out in giggles, which Cytada could only share, as if she was a child learning some naughty secret. Her giggling seemed to grow and grow in her until she thought it might never stop. And then it did stop, and the night was silent. Everything had changed, and forever. It seemed to Cytada that she stood in the middle of a glade that was bathed in the silvery light of a flaming moon. "See the beauty of the garment you have made," said the man. He was in front of her, but the cloak was not her cloak, but a cloak of feathers that might not have been feathers, but silvery flames, or just points of light. It engulfed him and lifted him, so he seemed to hover a stool's height above the ground. The farmer and his wife were nowhere to be seen. "You have never been loved," said the traveller.
"Sir, I have not," she said.
"And you have not known until this moment that you could be loved," he said.
"I have not."
"I can only love your kind," he said. "Who could love the princes and the heroes, with their murders and their wars?"
"I know no princes or heroes, sir."
"Bide your time," he said. "You'll be sick to your back teeth of them before you're done." He smiled at her. "You, my dear, are perfect."
"My face is not, sir."
"You chose imperfection. What could be more perfect? You saw your imperfection was perfection, and therefore remedied it by imposing an imperfection on yourself, thereby becoming perfect again. The logic is imperfectly flawless." He descended to the earth, and the cloak he had been wearing became a carpet of white feathers that covered the glade, deep as midwinter snow. She lay down upon it, and having only ever known straw before, was overwhelmed by its comfort. The stranger spoke. "To strive to be the best, to excel and have the skalds sing your praises, they're all at it. What better than to spit at what the gods gave you and spite your fate?"
"I did it because I would not give them a moment's more pleasure from me."
"They will have no pleasure ever again. Would you know their fate?"
"If it is a bad one."
"I have repaid them," said the burning, beautiful god, for now Cytada was sure this was not a mortal before her. "You should have seen the smith's face when I spoke to him from the fire, and he knocked that smelting pot onto his bollocks. He's got his cock out of his breeks for a different reason now, I can tell you. Are you grateful?"
"It is not enough,"
said Cytada. He stretched out his hand, and she saw the smith asleep in his bed. He was drawn and pale, but something obscured her vision. It was smoke. The thatch was on fire. The smith woke and tried to move, but his wounds wouldn't allow him to. She saw him panic as the fire took hold. Saitada smiled as she watched.
"You are a power, lady, a power," said the god. "The elves sing your fame, and the dwarfs of the earth despair, for they know that in all their art they will never make anything to compare to your depthless beauty."
"I would know your name, sir," said Saitada.
She felt something strange sweeping over her, something she had never felt from a man before. Love, as more than an idea, as something present and intense, like her forgotten mother might have cherished her baby girl.
"My name," said the traveller.
"Name?"
"Lady, like you, my magnificence cannot be contained by just one. First, you must know me better. You must see what I am up against." The odor of blood and fire filled the glade.
There was a clamor and a hammering, like the sound of the smith's shop increased a thousandfold, metal on metal, metal on wood. Saitada knew it by instinct, the noise of battle. At the edge of the glade stood a tall gray man with a beard, wearing a wide-brimmed hat. He had a patch over one eye, and two huge wolves lay panting at his feet, their teeth as big as knives. The expression on the man's face was terrible. Saitada had seen it before. It was the look men wore at cockfights, or when cheering two dogs to rip into each other. The look the smith's friends had worn as they'd held her down. A look of delight in violence and lust for more.
"See Odin, the king of the gods, in his hungers," said the traveller.
"See how he would know and consume and control."
"Father, let go!"
The old man said nothing, just stood there, frozen in his expression of malicious joy. The traveller went across and flicked the old man on the nose, but he did not respond.
"He would eat the world," said the traveller. "He would know it all, devour every mystery until the whole of creation came at his call. He's mad, you know. He drank so deeply of the knowledge well, but the waters splashed on that burning hunger and boiled all his brains. Yet still he wants to know, ever more, ever more."
"I would forget," said Saitada.
"Of course you would. It's the only sane thing to do. Not knowing is what gives the world its beauty. Who would know why the sun on the dew on a May morning makes the heart sing? That pervert would. Would you have no love, old man Odin? Would you snaffle down even a girl's secret heart's desires for a gorgeous, flame-haired fellow, and spew them out on a table in maps and runes? Would you chart the very stirrings of the heart? Well, lady, I think we should give this greedy knowledge glutton, this filthy wisdom hog, a right royal bite on the bum, don't you?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Saitada, though she didn't really understand what he meant. She only knew she wanted to please him.
"That's where you and I come in," said the traveller.
"Would you know my imperfections, lady?" "I know all I need to know of the imperfections of men," she said. "Though I think you are not a man."
"Whatever gave you that idea?" he said, as the fiery moon turned green and points of emerald light began to dance around the glade. The old man disappeared, then one wolf, then another, its body first, then its head apart from the mouth. Finally the tongue snapped back into the teeth and lips, and the glade was empty in a blink.
"I want you," she said.
"Well, That'd be a clue, wouldn't it? You could never love a man, and yet you love me.
I do, she said.
The pale god took her in his arms and kissed her. She felt at one with the moonlight, with the stars in the heavens, and, stranger than that, she felt all her fears and dreams consumed by the strange traveller and then fed back to her, sweet as honey on his lips. She took him to her and held him, and as their bodies joined, it seemed that so did their minds. A searing laughter filled her up, somewhere between malice and wild delight. But there was love there, too. She felt connected to every living thing on earth, felt the earthworms moving beneath her, the forests teeming, the cold spaces of the stars delicious and beautiful above her. The world felt precious, and the gods, who she sensed like a pressure at the back of her head, the gods with their bloodlust and their battles, seemed ridiculous, terrible, and contemptible. She stroked his skin, and it was wet with the blood of the wolf pelt. She found the crimson on the white of his flesh fascinating. Her hand was red with the wolf's blood. She licked it, and the taste of it seemed to fizz through her, as if tiny bubbles went popping all the way down inside her from her mouth to her knees. The god now had the wolf's head over his face. He peered through the animal's bloodied lids with cold eyes. The tongue that slithered from between the dead wolf's teeth was long and lascivious.
"What is your name?" she asked.
"Names are like clothes, lady. I have many."
"And which one do you wear tonight?"
The god smiled. She could see he liked her words. He pulled her to him, pressed his wolf lips to hers, and said,
"My name is Misery, and would you know yet more?" "Yes,"
said the girl, breathing in his scent, the scent of something beautiful, strange, and burned.
"I would know more."
He flicked at her lips with his tongue and whispered,
"So is yours."
The next morning the traveller was gone, along with the fine wolf pelt. Around Sitada's neck, tied in a strip of leather, was a strange stone. It was a token, the night caller had said, of his affection and protection. It didn't seem to do her much good. The livestock had been slaughtered. The dogs were dead, and Sitada was blamed for lying with a stranger while the wolf devoured the pigs. The farmer's wife wanted to forgive her, to comb her hair and call her daughter again, but the farmer, brave in the wolfless light of day, wanted revenge. She was sold, with only the clothes she stood up in and the pebble charm the strange fellow had given her, to her name. The priests had bought her, and told her to make a virtue of her suffering. When they discovered she was pregnant, they set to chastise her, but found they could not. Something about her, maybe the charm, maybe that eye that seemed to see all their sins, stopped them, and they let her live among them unpunished. Then Orphan had come. So what stopped Orphan's thoughts of murder on the ship? The stone at her neck was no more than a pebble with the head of a wolf scratched on it. Perhaps he had seen the rough little picture, his family sign, and felt some deep-seated fear that this foreign woman was kin. Or perhaps he just felt sorry for her. He looked north, up into the white-capped peaks, where he would meet Gulveig, Witch Queen of the Mountains, that mind-blown child. She had been no more than 10 years old when he'd first faced her the summer before. Orphan knew the stories surrounding her. As the old Witch Queen was dying, she had appeared to Gulveig's father, a warrior at the court of King Halfdan the Just. She had told him to take his pregnant wife to the Troll Wall to give birth. He knew better than to refuse, surrendered the girl child, and gave thanks for the luck the sacrifice would bring the family. Gullveig had been a decade in the dark of the mountain caves, breathing in magic like a fisherman's children breathe sea salt on the wind. Orthon looked at the mother cradling her twins. No, he couldn't kill her. He'd give her to the witches, he thought. The chosen boy would survive the journey from the wall to his wife without feeding. The girl couldn't even speak Orthon's language, would never know what had happened to her children. What harm could she do waiting on the witches? It wasn't as if she was going to escape them. No one could even find their way in and out of their caves without a guide. In this way, Orthon the Pitiless, burner of the Five Towns, allowed the privilege of life to a deformed slave that he would not allow to his kinsmen, and in so doing, sealed his fate. When they came ashore, the summer valley was pleasant and hummed with fertility, but Orthon could take no pleasure from the scenery. All his life he was a man of the necessary, someone who did what needed to be done and thought no more about it. He was pitiless, but as a means to an end. The fouler the fate of his enemies, the more tribute he could exact from others without having to lift a spear. But as the woman's strange eye seemed to watch him wherever he went, he could not rid himself of the image of Varin's face as he'd faced death and spoken of his wife. He would, he decided, carry the message to the widow as his first priority after he had given the child to his wife. There was a river between the coast and the troll wall, and Orthon would have liked to have sailed up it. Single-handed, however, it would be impossible. And anyway, the witches had called down enough rocks to make it impassable, even with a full crew. So they walked. The woman went in front of Orthon, where he could see her. Her hair hung loose, as the wimple the priests had made her wear was now in the North Sea. In her tatty fifth-hand nun's habit and the overlong cloak that had once belonged to Hela, she looked like a beggar. The king did, too, in his salt-stained cloak and sea furs. Orthon carried the moonsword tied on his back, hidden away. The hills, he knew, were full of trolls and bandits, and he didn't want to go advertising his wealth. They faced no supernatural opponents on their journey from the sea, but on the second day saw three riders approaching in the distance. The girl looked for cover, which Orthon thought a very reasonable course of action, for a woman. The king himself simply stood where he was. The men dismounted and approached, which Orthon took as a sure signal of violent intent. When taking on a warrior such as Orthon the Wolf, the best plan is to stalk him and cut him down in his sleep. Taunting him from afar and then approaching with, "What have we here?" is ill-advised. Still, Orthon, who was in a curiously melancholy mood, would have let the three pass, had the first not attempted to shake him by the shoulder. Orthon grasped the man's hand so he couldn't let go of his intended victim, took a pace back with his left foot to expose the arm, and in one movement drew the moonsword from his back and cut the limb in two. Before the bandit could realize what had happened, Orthon struck him again, this time hard to the leg. Orthon had no intention of killing him. Already he was thinking how he might use him. His leg damaged, the man had sought to steady himself, but had instinctively put his weight onto the missing hand at Orthon's collar. He fell forward at the king's feet, bleeding heavily. The remaining two robbers stared in disbelief at the moonsword. They knew now exactly who they were facing. They had heard so many stories of Orthon the Wolf, it was almost as if they knew him personally. One thing was clear in their minds. Fighting him was certain death. They tried to flee, but Orthon, even at 35, was too fast for them. The king had noticed, as soon as the men appeared, that both were wearing costly burnies. Thus encumbered, they died before they had run 20 paces. He cleaned his sword on the fallen men's clothes and returned to Saitada and the bleeding bandit. Working quickly, he took out a length of walrus cord from his pouch and tied off the man's arm to stop the bleeding. The bandit was unconscious, which suited Orthon. Saitada looked at the two bodies, and then at the king. He found himself explaining.
"If I'd let them go, they would have come back when we were sleeping. Perhaps in numbers," he said,
though he knew she couldn't understand.
"They're scavengers. They never paid for those horses. See the burnies? They're taken from the bodies of brave fools who came to steal the witch's treasure. Treasure that is only there to draw fools on to death. They use them in their magic, then they throw them from the rock."
The rock. In the distance they could see it. Already huge, 3 days' march away. It was their destination, the Troll Wall, as tall as 1,000 men standing on each other's shoulders. It was a monstrous, overhanging cliff, like something from a dream, an obstacle which blocks all further progress, something symbolic, with a resonance far beyond its daunting physical mass. He looked up at it. It was impossible, he thought, to imagine climbing it, though he had done so before. It was the only way into the witches' caves that the sisters were willing to reveal to outsiders. The back of the mountain was even more impassable, swathed in permanent ice and perilous loose boulders, and defended by hill tribes under the witches' thrall. So they would have to climb, almost to the top of the wall, and then into it, to the caves. Orthon knew, though, that the wall would not be the greatest impediment to seeing the Witch Queen. That would be the witches themselves. Chapter 4. The Troll Wall. Between the hour of the dog and the hour of the wolf, between waking and sleeping, between the light and the dark, is the doorway of shadows. Step on, traveller. Do not tarry on that grim threshold. Orthon read the runes someone had carved into a boulder. He was below the dizzying overhang of the Troll Wall, a cliff so high that the top was invisible in clouds. Human bones and rotting clothing lay about him, but it was the inscription that made him shiver. Mundane perils of bandits and falling rocks were bad enough without thinking of what other horrors waited in the dark. The wall would take even the fittest warrior 2 weeks to climb, even if he found one of the shifting roots around the overhang at the first attempt. But no one was that lucky. It was impossible to reach the caves in one go. Rock slides moved old paths, opened new ones, and closed others in a blink. You could climb almost to within touching distance of the top, and then have to turn, your way impassable, another route needed. The paths were becoming fewer, too, as if the mountain begrudged them and sought to shrug them off. How long would it be before there were none? Would the witches eventually be marooned and left to rot in their caves? Or were there other, hidden entrances that the sisters and their servants used? The climb, though, wasn't the biggest problem. The problem was, as the runes warned, sleep. For that tiny fall between waking and unconsciousness was where the witches were. People came to steal their treasure and died. People came to seek their advice and died. Very few, armed with charms and acceptable tribute, ever came back alive, and of those, no one was ever stupid enough to seek a second audience. No one but Orthon and his ancestors, who, by divine right, it was said, could hold regular counsel with the witches. Even to the Wolf King, though, the prospect was daunting. This was his second visit, and he hoped he would never have to make a third. They would have to wait for a guide, he knew, dangerous as that might be. Orthon saw no point in exhausting himself and the woman by attempting the climb unaided. At the base there was the risk of bandits, but better that than the children should fall to their deaths. He made a fire, drank water from a skin, fed bread and salted fish to Saitada, and made sure the bandit was just about alive. Then he lay down and pretended to sleep for a bit, to see what the woman would do. She fed her children and settled down to sleep herself. She was, as he guessed, no idiot. She wasn't going to kill her only protector in a strange and hostile wilderness, or even run away from him. The bandit was too badly injured to attempt anything. Orthon wanted to take the precaution of breaking his remaining arm, but feared that the shock might kill him. So, instead, he just tied him with walrus cord to a tree. Then he prepared for sleep properly, and waited for the witch to come. If it was the witch queen, all well and good. If it was one of the stranger sisters, well... Orthon was a warrior, so he concentrated on what he would do if the worst came to the worst, not what would become of him. He would try to give her the bandit, then the woman, after that, himself. With luck, the witch queen would appear in time to save the children. But sleep wouldn't come for him. The night was fine and temperate, and he was warm in his cloak. But little irritation seemed to keep him awake. A cold nose, a pebble in the small of the back, the smell of the moss on the rock, the taste of the rock even. Then he realized he was not awake, but neither was he dreaming. Some of his senses seemed heightened. He could taste the cold on the air like iron, smell the difference between the flowers and the grasses. He could smell the tar and the dirt of a puddle. It was as if his hearing was slightly muted, his vision reattuned so that in the bright moon glare he could see new colours. Deep, mettled blues, sparkling dark greens, and seams of gold on the side of the rock. He was where the witches were, he knew, in that place between waking and sleeping. He went to the tree and cut loose the bandit, in preparation for what was to come. Cries in the dark, like a baby wailing. Orthon wanted to prepare the woman for the arrival of the witch, but they shared no language. She would just have to suffer it. He heard a voice through the rain. Where had the rain come from? He tasted it on his lips, more iron, like the way the hand smells after handling a sword, like blood.
Mother in the pen! Mother in the pen!
It was a child's voice, high and piping, but clearly audible. Orthon didn't want to look, but knew that he must. If it was the witch queen, then she would have to see him. He pulled the semi-conscious bandit to him, ready to throw him to the witch. Down along the rock face, he could see a young woman bent over as she tried to shield herself from the driving rain. She had something in her arms. It was a baby. Orthon turned to Saitada. She was holding both her children close to her. The woman staggered out from the cliff face with the baby and laid it on the ground. She took off its swaddling clothes and exposed it naked to the elements. Then she ran off into the night. Orthon stayed where he was. The witches had all sorts of tricks, and he wasn't about to fall for one so easily. He watched as the child died. After a short while it stopped moving, and then seemed to disappear. So this was magic. Orthon kept his hand on his sword. And then the rain stopped, and it seemed that it was a lovely summer evening. The same woman who had left the baby appeared, but this time dressed in farm girl's finery, as if she was going to a dance. A man, also in his country best, walked past her, kissed her hand, and seemed to tell her not to be late. Orthon recognized the story. It was a fairy tale about an unmarried woman who had exposed her child to die rather than face the hardship of raising it. How did the story end? He couldn't remember. The woman smiled and sat on a stool that had appeared from somewhere. She was combing her hair. She finished and got up. Orthon recalled that the story told she had gone to check on the pigs before leaving for the dance. She looked into a trough and from within it took something cold and blue. It was a baby, and Orthon knew it was dead. The woman held the dead child up and looked at it as it began to move, kicking out its legs as if attempting a jig. And then the rhyme began, a rhyme that seemed to come from inside his head.
Mother in the pen, mother in the pen, primp and preen to charm the men, take my swaddling clothes and dance in them.
As the rhyme split its way through his mind, all he could see was Varin's face, bloated, white, and drowned.
What had he done? What had he done?
The rain came down again, straight and hard in the windless evening. Suddenly it was night, pitch black, and the young woman, her face pale with madness, clasping the dead child to her, was at Orthon's side. Even the king screamed, though he didn't forget to push the wounded bandit towards the witch. It was as if the man's body was swallowed by the night. The king knew that he wasn't facing the witch queen. She would have recognized him. It was a patrolling witch, mistaking him for another plunderer. Or worse, it was one of the truly terrible sisters, her mind simmering with magic, some half-demon who leaked delusions and madness to those around her, and who could kill them without even noticing they were there.
"Gulveig! Gulveig!" shouted Orthon at the top of his voice. "Help us, lady!"
The moonsword was out, and he looked around for whatever would come next. The light was so inconstant, one instant, flat dark, the next, the pale washed-out murk of a rain-soaked dusk. He wanted to find Sitada, to throw her to the witch, but she was not there.
"Orthon the wolf," said a child's voice in his head. "Mightiest warrior in Midgard. Is there no one who can defeat you in arms?"
"Gulveig! Gulveig!"
Orthon screamed, trying to make the witch queen hear him. He must not reply, he knew. He must not accept the delusion, enter into it, and become consumed by it.
"I know one who can lay you low. I know one who can prick you so. If you defeat this one I know, then, King Wolf, I will let you go."
No mortal had ever challenged him and lived. He did what he had sworn not to. He answered the voice.
"Bring forth your champion!"
Behind the veil of rain there was a shimmering, and the shape of a man took form. It seemed to Orthon that the witch had underestimated him. His opponent was a man of near 40 with long white hair and a straggly beard. He looked careworn and beaten by his years, but there was something in his hand that shone with a cold fire. It was a sword, curved, slim and wicked. Even in the dullness of the rain it gleamed. Orthon recognized it at the same time he recognized his opponent. It was the moonsword. His opponent was himself. As the realization hit him, something very strange happened. He saw himself with his back to the rock, and he saw himself advancing towards the rock. He seemed to be both warriors at the same time, looking out through both men's eyes. He could see a white figure with a woman and two babies at his back, but at the same time he could see the same white figure advancing from the rock and hear the cry of the boys behind him. Orthon did not know which warrior he was, and in some way he was both. More reflective men might have wondered what to do, but Orthon, both Orthons, had been brought up to value swift action. The kings closed with each other and began to fight. It was a hopeless struggle, each man guessing the other's moves, each anticipating blows and ducking beneath them or stepping away so their swords sliced through thin air. All things being equal, they could have fought like that forever. But all things are not equal. What we do and how we react is not the same when we are facing up a slope as when we are facing down. Orthon might instinctively know his opposing self might offer three feints and then a strike to the legs, but he couldn't know by how much the ground had raised one of his attacker's legs higher than the other, where the disposition of his weight lay, largely on one foot, largely on the other, or spread. He could not guess when the rain would blind his eyes or when it would clear from his opponents. Also, what do you do facing a rock, looking only at blackness, is different to what you do facing a man with a moving background of trees. We are not the same people facing north as we are facing south. Humans are an inconstant and contingent race. So the king did strike himself, a glancing blow to his flank. Orthon felt pleased he had drawn first blood, but was also alarmed that he had been wounded. But then the king who struck the blow felt something in his side. An identical wound to the one he had inflicted had appeared. The king could not stop, could not back down, was incapable of even having such an idea. So he struck again and hit again, and both kings took a wound to the forearm, then one to the ear, then the hand. Who hit and who received the blows became unclear, but Orthon kept fighting because that was the only option for someone raised to believe the sword was the answer to everything. One thing was plain to Sitarda, though. If the fight went on, she was about to lose her children's guardian. Clinging to the boys, she wouldn't leave them. She sprang out into the rain to interpose herself between the warriors.
"No!"
she shouted.
"Enough!"
But her words, incomprehensible to the kings, were lost in the rain, and suddenly it was as if a giant hand had lifted her from the ground, and she was shooting up through the sodden air, up the cliff, up and up and up. Then she heard a strange, childish voice speak to her.
"Die!"
it said. She was falling, squeezing her babies to her. Then it was light and quiet, and the same voice spoke again.
"Forgive me, Lord Loki,"
it said. "Sister, we all make mistakes. Forget the error, and forget me too," said Sitarda, though it wasn't her voice. It was the voice of the strange traveller, the boy's father. And then she was on the ground below the rock, and Orthon, blood-stained and panting, was standing over her. It was dawn, and the sun warmed her face.
"They've sent a boy to guide us," said the king. "See to the children, and then we'll get going."
Strangely, she understood him, though he was still speaking his own language. A pale child of about 8 was in front of them, laden with protective charms, arm rings, amulets, and talismans.
"Follow,"
he said. And they set off on the arduous journey across the troll wall and up to the witch's realm. Chapter 5. The Loss of Sons. The cliff was perilous, and it was becoming clear to Orthon that they would not reach the top. The woman had finally yielded her children, and they were strapped, wriggling and squalling to the king, the mother checking their bindings with irritating regularity. Orthon still shivered to look at her, but he could not yet cast her aside. He shivered still more when he thought of the ordeal that faced him in meeting the witch queen.
"Do you know where you are going, child?"
he asked the boy. The boy just kept on climbing. It had been a still day at the bottom, but here, an inexorable 10 days up, along winding paths, down others, braving terrible scrambles and awful jumps, the wind almost flattened the climbers to the rock. Orthon had thought the slave girl would never make it. There was a path, not that you would see it from the bottom, but it was so narrow in places that even Orthon, who had stared down death so many times without blinking, felt a tightness in his stomach as he trusted his life to a root or a fingerhold. He did not look down. They slept, tied onto the cliff with ropes and pegs the boy had with him, and surrounded by charms. The child seemed not to sleep, but spent the night chanting a strange song to a broken tune in a language Orthon did not understand. The only thing that troubled the king's dreams was the anticipation of what was to come. And then the overhang became serious, impassable. How had he reached the witches before, Orthon couldn't remember. He remembered only the prophecy, the witch queen's presence, and the dark. Inside the clouds, visibility down to a few paces, the path finally gave out. The child guide seemed to have missed the entrance to the caves. Orthon felt the fear drying his mouth. He was weak, the girl was weaker. They wouldn't survive the climb down, even if the boy agreed to guide them. The boy clambered back around Orthon, back around Cytada, and then, just visible in the clinging mist, he beckoned them. There in the rock was a gap, no more than a crack. It was only a shoulder's width, and scarcely as tall as a man. Orthon would not be able to pass through it with the children, and even without them would have to turn sideways and wriggle his way in. He peered into the blackness and smelled the deep earth. He could see nothing at all, but he had to go on. He untied the infants and gave them to their mother. Then he slid inside after the boy. There was only the weak light from outside to see by. He could see an arm's length, maybe a little more, in front of his face, but after that, nothing. The mother passed her wailing children in. She was committed to Orthon now, whether she liked it or not, and had no other option than to follow. Orthon tied the infants to him and watched the girl climb through. He had come to admire her, and had certainly known men with less resolve. She needed no coaxing, morale-building, or bullying. She just followed. The child guide stood very close to them and unwound a long cord from his waist. He passed it to the king and gestured for him to tie it to himself and allow Cytada to take it too. She did. Then they went down into the dark. Thoughts came and went in the blackness as Orthon fought to keep his footing and protect the children. The entrance on the wall, he thought, must be how the witches admitted their few guests. It was too impractical as an everyday access. How did they eat? How did they come forth to visit in the night, to sit at the end of a stunned farmer's bed and barter magic for children? There must be other ways in and out, thought Orthon, unless they could fly, as was the rumour. In the dark he became acutely aware of his breathing, of that of the children and the woman behind him, and of his footfalls, heavy and uncertain. He lost purchase on time. At one point he heard water and felt the boy take his hand and thrust it into a stream. He drank and helped Cytada do the same. They rested a while, and he passed the babies to the girl to be fed. He was aware of how young and fragile they felt as he gave them over. How had the girl endured this journey so soon after giving birth? He admired her. Then the descent continued, sightless. His hands scraped on rock. He stumbled. He felt the boy push him back as they slowed to clamber over a rockfall or squeeze through a bone-crushing passageway. Orthon felt terribly vulnerable and hated it. The dark was an enemy he couldn't fight. There a child could maroon him and he would be doomed. On they went, down and down, first cold, then hot. They rested again and then again. Had they been inside a day? Orthon thought so. Down, down, down through galleries blind and cold, crawling into tiny fissures that scraped his face and arms as he wriggled through them. Standing room could have been just out of reach to his left or right, and he wouldn't have known. And still down, the children's wails echoing through vast chambers, or deadened by long coffins of rock. How long now? 2 days? Perhaps. Breathing became difficult. Balance had to be fought for. The air itself seemed weak and lifeless. And then Orthon felt the rope go slack to his front and heard childish footsteps going away. He pulled the taut end towards him and held Sitada to him with a tenderness that had never come as naturally before. He heard his own voice shaking. "We will overcome. Do not let go of the rope." He felt to see that she had tied it to her wrist. She had. "Sleep," he said. He didn't expect her to understand, but she did. Not just his words, but his feelings of concern and tenderness. She sat down. What else was there to do? Moisture clung to Orthon's skin. He was sweating, and then he was shivering. He felt around where he was sitting, aware that he could be a step away from a terrible drop. He pulled the girl to him, presenting her children to her. The terrible danger of their situation made them seem even more precious to him. The girl fed the babies, and Orthon struggled with the fixings of his scabbard, releasing the cords. When the mother passed the children back, he tied their feet to his belt, stowing his sword under the boots he used for a pillow. For the first time in his life, he valued something more than his weapon in a time of danger. It seemed to Orthon that sleep came. But what is waking and what is sleeping in such darkness? The body has its rhythms of hunger and excretion, but when hunger is constant and water scarce, these cease to mark time. The woman's milk failed, and the children's wailing became constant. Then, after a while, it ceased.
"Hoo!"
A voice was close in the dark, the word like a note on a flute.
"Lady?"
"Hoo!"
Again, like the hoot of an owl, its breath near to him, foul and hot. Orthon imagined some giant bird next to him in the dark, picking him over in its claws.
"I am Orthon, king of the Horder. I bring tribute of gold and slaves to the palace of the Witch Queen."
"Hoo!"
Orthon felt something climb over him. It was a human form, frail and light, but still the king had to restrain himself from reaching for the sword. No. Whatever it was, they were at its mercy.
"Hoo!"
Orthon breathed in. Would the Valkyries find him down here, he wondered, to take him to Valhalla to feast forever? Or would it be just that damp, dark, always? He reached to his side. Then he realized the cords on his belt were loose, and the children were gone. A guttering flame burned the king's eyes, and he moved to shield them. In a glimpse, he saw, leaning over Sitada and the babies, a tiny old woman in a white shift. Above her, in a flicker of gold, almost like a flame herself in that light, stood the Witch Queen, that grim child, pale and beautiful, crowned in an impossible tangle of golden cables, rubies, emeralds, diamonds, and sapphires, like a dragon's hoard in miniature. At her throat was a rich necklace whose jewels burned with a light familiar to Orthon. It was the light he'd seen as he sacked the five towns, the light of the burning village from which he'd taken the child, the light of destruction. Then it was gone, and he could see nothing. A baby was thrust into Orthon's hands, then some sort of object. It was a small leather bottle, half full with liquid, he could feel. No one spoke, though he understood what it was. Medicine to give his wife, to complete the deception.
"The mother will come with me," said the king.
"Hoo!"
The older woman's idiot hoot again. Orthon must have been dreaming, because all around him tiny lights came on and went out, the faces of the strange sisters appearing for an instant and then vanishing again. Wherever they were, it seemed, was wreathed in gold. Arms and armour, cups and plates, fine arm rings and gilded chests of coins. The king used the light to locate his sword. His hand closed on it, and he had to will the tension from his fingers. If he was going to fight, he would need to be relaxed. Too tight a grip would rob him of speed. The mother?
Who?
Orthon was finding his ordeal almost unbearable. He longed for the real light, for the feel of the breeze and the taste of rain. And then it was dark again, and he didn't know for how long. He awoke by the bank of a river. The moon sword was gone, but the baby was at his side. He was terribly thirsty and plunged his head into the water and drank like a dog. Then he turned to the child. It was filthy, but looked well enough. It was crying, at least, which Orthon took for a sign of health. He looked at the troll wall, far in the distance, still immense. He washed the child and thought of all the sorrow that had surrounded it up until that point, the deaths and the deception that had brought them to where they were. Even the death of the bandits played on his mind. There were his kinsmen left on the river beach, Varin, weighed down by the Burnie, swallowed by the sea. That poor girl with her hideous face. What had become of her? At the very best, she had lost one of her babies. At the worst, still alive and alone in that awful dark for as long as it took for thirst to kill her. On any other day of his life, Orthon would have regarded these things as simply the way of fate, unpleasant briars he'd had to pick through to get to the clear path ahead. But, though he didn't know her name, he thought of Cytada, and, alone by the water, Orthon the Pitiless wept. Then he wrapped the child in his cloak and headed for the cabin, 5 days away at a comfortable pace, where his wife lay supposedly pregnant. He looked at the baby. It needed a wet nurse and wouldn't last that long. He would need to do the journey in much less than that. Never mind. After the stagnant air of the cave, it would be good to feel the exhaustion of movement. By the water's edge, on his way, he saw hoofprints, maybe 2 riders. He only had his knife. But if he could kill a horseman, then he could be at the cabin in perhaps a couple of days, maybe less, if he could get a second horse. More deaths would be needed before he reached his homeland. Chapter 6 Wolfsangel. Had Orthon been of a more reflective nature, he might have wondered why the witches had been so generous as to grant him the son he longed for. He would have suspected unasked-for generosity in any rival king, and expected it as a right from a visiting ambassador. But the witches belonged to another realm entirely. They were in the sphere of the supernatural, the unguessable, similar to providence or fate, and he didn't question their gift any more than he would have a whale beaching on his shores, or a good wind for his longships on a raid. It would have surprised him to learn that the witches were acting from something as mundane as fear. Though the women of the Troll Wall were considered monsters by the people and kings from whom they took their tribute, they were really not so very different to the terrified farmers, jarls, and thralls who left their gifts of food, drink, and children on the mountainside. The fisherman who had lost his boy, for instance, thought of the witches as monsters. He couldn't say if he had been waking or dreaming that midnight when the air in his house had seemed as tight and cold as a compress on his skin, and the thing he had glimpsed from the side of his eye vanished when he turned to look at it properly. The lad had woken in the morning and said the women had called to him, so the fisherman had taken him to the mountain. There was no other way, he knew. The consequences of refusal would be visited on all his people, not just his own family. The man had watched, trembling, as his son walked away and was swallowed by the fog. He couldn't have imagined that the witches felt anything at all, least of all fear. But the women were afraid. What is prophecy? It is a wide thing of many forms. We don't call a person who anticipates a cat will knock over a cup and moves to catch it a prophet. We don't maintain that the ability to look at the clouds and say it will rain makes you a seer. Even in the summer, we know the cold of winter will come, but no one claims magic powers for that. These predictions are part of our everyday experience of the future, not a veiled and mysterious thing, but something that connects directly to the present. In the crags and caves of the troll wall, behind that door in the face of the cliff that you would not see, could not see if you were not invited there, the Witch Queen's powers of prophecy were not unrelated to those possessed by us all. The boundaries between the present and the future are not as strong as we imagine, and the Witch Queen had sweated, frozen, starved, and hallucinated until hers were not strong at all. Prophecies were not something external to her, something she made or said. They were part of her consciousness, the way she saw the world. They were like a language she spoke. And for a year before the Queen had sent Orthon on his mission, that language had hissed softly of a threat. It did not arrive wholly formed one day, but rather started like a suspicion or even a rumour, a whisper beneath the rush of the cave streams, or a cold that crept too far into the earth and left her shivering even in the wolf chamber, where the breath of a fettered god heated the rock so it was painful to touch. The feeling grew in her as she sat in the dark, and it grew in the other sisters. As the witches eroded the distinction between today and tomorrow, they blurred the lines between me, you, she and it. Their experiences were like possessions that could be lent, borrowed, or shared. Minor magics were used to clarify the sense of foreboding. The sisters lit a whale blubber candle and asked it for a vision. They could have asked anything to direct them, but they chose the candle because it had once been a living thing, and so its connections to the outside world were more solid than those of the rocks of the caves. First, the candle revealed its past, as it would to anyone, the fish stink filling the cave. The sisters, though, could sense more. They breathed in the stress that had seeped into the fat with the whale's beaching, its discovery by hunters, and its killing. The candle burned on, and they began to see that, for the prophecy, the quality of its light was the important thing. Then a sister, because it felt right, reached forward and snuffed out the flame. The light disappeared, but the thought of the light, its residue, filled the witches' minds. Underneath the sickly yellow of the flame, they thought, was a darker colour, a bright slate, the colour of the sky before a storm. The link was followed, and rainwater was brought down in a cup from the top of the wall, and it was noticed that the water felt heavier than normal water, or rather, it held a sentiment, a wish. The water, thought the sisters, still wanted to fall, to be rain again. The smell of it, too, was sharp, like ozone. The link to the coming storm seemed stronger. A witch went to the top of the wall to observe the birds. They had moved from the north face of the mountain and came around to the south. In the valley, she could sense, other animals were moving to shelter. The gulls had come inland, and insects were burrowing into the earth. Why were these things happening? Because the witches were looking. The animals didn't move to offer auguries to the ordinary people of the mountains. The portent was clear then. A storm. A magical storm. In the winter, the message became clearer. The smoke on the wind bore the scent of funeral fires. The rats that ran through the caves seemed to carry an excitement and an expectation. More ravens than gulls were seen in the sky. A vision of the hangman's tree seemed to resonate in the witches' minds day and night, the creaking of the rope waking them from their dreams, intruding on rituals where it had no place. Death was all around them, they knew, waiting for